Listen, there's a reason the ultra-wealthy have been investing in fine wine for centuries. Historically stable returns and a lack of volatility make it stand out compared to traditional assets, especially during a downturn. But now you can invest alongside with them with Vint. Vint is an SEC-qualified investment platform that offers shares of the most sought-after wines in the world. So join the thousands of investors diversifying with fine wine and spirits. Learn more at Vint.co. For full investment disclosure information and more, visit Vint.co. Listen, there's a reason the ultra-wealthy have been investing in fine wine for centuries. Historically stable returns and a lack of volatility make it stand out compared to traditional assets, especially during a downturn. But now you can invest alongside with them with Vint. Vint is an SEC-qualified investment platform that offers shares of the most sought-after wines in the world. So join the thousands of investors diversifying with fine wine and spirits. Learn more at Vint.co. For full investment disclosure information and more, visit Vint.co.
This week in Around the Coin, we interview Joe Bayon, the CEO of Grow Credit. Joe and I have known each other since working together at Science Inc., a technology studio located in Santa Monica, California. Over the past decade, Joe's specialized in underwriting, credit score improvement, user acquisition. Joe is an incredibly persistent guy. The team at Grow Credit has established relationships with banks and credit unions prior to even launching. Previous to this, Joe was the founder at ICS Mobile. They built the app called the Free App a Day, which grew to 12 million users worldwide. They bootstrapped the company and they got it to 20 million in total revenue. So that was his initial foray. Previous to that, Joe was a track star. He was an Olympic level and collegiate competitive track athlete. And we discuss his story, how he went from France on a scholarship with track to starting one of the most successful and groundbreaking financial technology companies called Grow Credit. The show, as a reminder, is sponsored by Redeem and Otter. As a note, I should mention I'm an investor and partner in these two companies, which is why I love them so much and sponsor them on the show. Otter Labs, spelled O-T-T-E-R, the website is hireotter.com, is a staff augmentation company. So if you or someone you know is looking to hire developers, now is a great time to find remote developers since every company is now remote. We find developers in Argentina. We've been building a network of great talent down there for about 3 years. My previous company, Home Hero, we had a team of about 15 developers down in Argentina. And when we sold the company, we wanted to place those engineers because the acquirer wasn't going to hire them. So I basically contacted my founder friends looking to hire, and that just kind of snowballed into the network that it is today. So if you're looking for great and inexpensive developers, reach out to us at hireotter.com. Also, we are sponsored today by Redeem, spelled R-E-D-triple-E-E-M. Redeem is the safest place to trade Bitcoin for discounted gift cards. My partner Kyle and I started the company in 2018, and we built it to facilitate the on-ramp of cryptocurrency. I'm a big believer that gift cards are a mechanism for transacting cryptocurrency and making it useful. It's a way for people to get into crypto very easily. We have AML and KYC, and the discounted gift cards are between 15 and 20% frequently. So it's a great place to buy Amazon, Walmart, eBay, Best Buy. There's dozens of others. Check it out, redeem.com, R-E-D-E-E-E-M, and on with the show.
All right, we are live, Joe. Welcome on Around the Coin. How are you doing?
Hey, how are you, Mike? I'm doing fine, thanks.
Great. So Joe Bayon is the founder of Grow Credit. Joe, do you want to just give a little background for listeners, like include your personal background, but you and I met through Science, the accelerator incubator in Santa Monica a number of years ago. And I just loved hanging out with you. You know, we went out a few times. I got your story years ago, but I'd enjoy hearing it again to kind of catch us up from, you know, your time at college and track all the way to now in growing Grow Credit.
Yeah, well, Yeah, good times at Science. You know, it was I think about five years ago now. So it's been a little while. So I have an unusual background, to say the least. And I was born in Cameroon in Africa, and moved to Paris when I was 2 years old. I was raised in France. You know, French is my first language. And as a senior in high school, you know, I always wanted to come study in the United States, and the only way to achieve that dream was through athletics. So as a senior in high school, I decided to run track, and I finished fifth at the French Nationals. So you know, that's basically how I booked my ticket here. You know, I spent a couple of years at Santa Monica College out here in LA. Under Coach Smith, you know, the legendary Coach Tommy Smith, who won the 1968 Olympics, and then he, you know, he helped me run even faster, and which allowed me to, you know, to obtain a full ride at the University of Miami.
So, what was your specialty distance?
I was the 100, 200, and long jump.
Wow. And to put it in context, what was your best time on the 100?
It was, you know, just a regular 10-4, nothing too fancy, but fast,
regular.
Fast enough.
Regular about that.
Nowadays, you know, when you see those guys running at 9.6, 9.7, you know, I was pedestrian. But, you know, it was still good enough to give me a ride at Miami, and I was fortunate that I attended school during the good years where, you know, we were winning everything at football. And because of Title IX, actually something very unusual, because of Title IX, it was only like two men's scholarship, and the rest of the team was the football team. So, you know, the 4x1 was basically me and all those, major big names that went on to the NFL. And it was me, Santana Moss, Clinton Portis, Andre Johnson, you know, Willis McGahee, Ed Reed was part of the team as well, though he was doing the javelin. He was the biggest champion, you know, at javelin with no practice. Talk about
wow
nature. Yeah,
but exactly. Those guys, you competed with those guys?
They were on my team. They were with me. They were a part of the, it was the track team. They were the track team and me.
You had those guys are like all pro football. Yeah, those aren't just average NFL players.
I was there in 99, 2000, 2001. So it was the year where we were just, you know, I think I went to college. We lost one game against Washington.
Wow.
So, yeah. You know, it was.
You didn't play football there. I mean, you're a big guy. You could have played football. Did you think about it?
Yeah. I mean, I came from Europe, right? I played soccer. So football was a bit of a stretch in a sense that, you know, I never wore pads. They wanted me to play, you know, but it wasn't my thing, you know. It was, you know, I wasn't raised with that culture. So, you know, I, you know, of course, when they signed those monstrous contracts, it would have been tempting. But, you know, I mean, the risks from a health standpoint, you know, and all the CTE, issues, you know, yeah. So I, you know, it was best for me. You know, I'm glad I just stuck with them. You know, with track, and so that's what I did there. You know, graduated in 2001. I graduated in my major was international finance and marketing, and after that, I spent a couple of years, you know, running track in the European circuit. There's a small circuit there, you know, nothing fancy. I was just trying to make it to the 2004 Olympics, and then I got injured right before the Olympics. You know, right? You know, and this is actually how my business career started, because I went on to randomly. I mean, this is how life is. You know, completely randomly, I was I went back to my track club in France, which was actually in the middle of nowhere in Clermont-Ferrand, which is where the Michelin tires headquarters are. I picked that team just completely randomly. You know, it's a long story. But anyways, I was on my way there when I randomly met someone on a train cart, you know, who was working on his computer. You know, he had long hair, working on his computer. And I was wondering, what is he doing? You know, focused for an hour and a half. It was just typing and all. So I'm very curious. So I asked him, what do you do? And he went on to tell me that he built, this company built, you know, basically technology that was literally 20 years ahead of their time. And, but only their main clients were here in Los Angeles. You know, their main clients was, the main clients were post-production companies. You know, it was basically a plugin for Adobe After Effects and Photoshop. You know, that was, it was a procedural textures plugin. And what was unique about their technology was the fact that, you know, it gave artists the ability to paint math. And basically a procedural texture is mathematically generated, a math-generated texture. But the problem before was, you know, you would go to a programmer and ask him that, hey, I need a wood texture for my game, or I need a wood texture for, you know, this architecture that I'm building. And, you know, the problem with that is the programmer would create it, but the artist would have absolutely no control over the final product. And what they did, they created a system which allows the artist to retouch, you know, any texture, you know, a mathematically created texture, and it would still remain a mathematical formula. So what happened all of a sudden is they were able to create photorealistic, you know, scenery, which still remained very light, you know, from programmatically, in a sense that, you know, from that point on, they could make games that looked a lot better, but that was very light in terms of, in terms of weight, essentially. And okay. That was 20 years ahead of their time. And they expanded that technology into the gaming environment. And, you know, and nowadays, you know, it's an amazing entrepreneurial story. Nowadays, 95% of the games are using their big title, the top titles are using their technology to build games, essentially. And
what is this company?
It's called Allegorithmic, and uh-huh. They were purchased by Adobe last year.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah. So I met this, you know, I was employee number 8. You know, basically I met him and he told me, hey, that's what we're doing. And I told him, hey, I'm an international finance and marketing major. Maybe I can help you out. And he told me that maybe I should talk to his boss. He was coming to pick him up at the train station. So I met him. He told me to come to the office, to see what they were doing. I went there and I spent the next 8 weeks just studying their technologies, what they were doing. And after 8 weeks, they gave me the gig to be, you know, their business developer out here in LA.
And wow!
So, So that's how I started with tech. You know, so
that's what moved you to LA. You came
that's
out
what
for
moved
this.
Me to LA. That remember, I came here. I was in LA first at Santa Monica College, then I went back to. Then I went to Miami where I ran track, and then that experience sent me back to LA, but in 2004. So I was, wow. I came here and So that's how I came back to LA in 2004.
And then you quit that job. And what was the next thing that you worked on?
The next thing was, so I would, you know, I spent three years there, helped them develop their business. They did amazingly well. I mean, I was, you know, and then after that, you know, a company called Infusio Games, same thing, completely randomly, this time in France. I was on vacation in France. And, you know, they asked me, you know, it was through a friend of a friend, they needed someone to become a chief operating officer for the game studio here in LA. And I met the team over there in France, and they gave me the job, you know. And Infusio Games was famous for having developed Microsoft Microsoft Age of Empire 2 for mobile. So that was one of the big titles that they had. And so 3 years later, I was, you know, running the company, their LA office. And I spent about a year and a half, you know, there. And then the iPhone was coming along, you know, and I was highly suggesting the team out there to start developing iPhone titles. But, you know, they were a little bit slow to make that move. And I became a little bit frustrated because I really thought that, you know, the iPhone was the future. So I decided to, you know, to go on my own and start my own company. So I started ICS Mobile, which was, a game development studio initially. I mean, there was, you know, I'm giving you the short, you know, version here because there was a couple of pivots before becoming a full game development studio. But, we started as a mobile ad platform, you know, because we had a technology which allowed us to push video ads, you know, on feature phones. So that's how it initially started at. And then it all happened between 2008. So it was really hard to raise funding. So with that technology, actually, we made a deal with NBC Universal, and we developed a game called, for the TV show Heroes from back then. So, you know, you remember that show Heroes on the NBC?
Yeah, Heroes? I'm trying to reboot my memory. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So we did a trivia game, but using our technology, which allows us to push video ads. And the ads were actually Sprint PCS ads. So that was the first technology that we built that combined video games and ads as well. So I tried to pitch, you know, the technology and the solution to all the VCs in the world back in 2008. And guess what? It was 2008. So it was very hard to raise funding. And then I was unsuccessful in raising funding. And then I pivoted towards developing a mobile coupon platform, basically Groupon before Groupon, you know.
This was Free App a Day.
That was before Free App a Day. So I see before we started with first, we started to pitch that, you know, that technology to push video ads. That didn't work. We pivoted to a mobile coupon platform. You know, essentially it was just basically a Groupon before Groupon. And then we pitched it to a bunch of funds, we pitched it to KBCB, and they told me, well, that's a good idea, but, you know, how do we know that you are the team that we'll be able to develop it? Well, you know, because we didn't have a background or even any success, you know, we didn't have any prior success, you know, founding, VC, back startup. So, you know, the challenge was how do you convince someone that you are the one that would be able to develop, you know, a successful mobile coupon platform. So that's the challenge that we faced. That didn't work out. And then I decided to move forward and start a game development studio. So I hired, you know, a few young guys from a Full Sail in Florida. They just came in town because keep in mind, I'm not a coder. I'm not a developer. I'm a creative guy. And I just told them that, hey, let's make some games pretty much. And we developed a title. You know, back then it was a tower defense titles were very popular in the App Store. And I decided to become a little bit more creative and create. And I decided to create a tower defense games that would sit on water. There's the app that was Koi Pond. I don't know if you remember that app where you have fish that could swim, but if you tap the screen, you know, the water was very photorealistic. And I decided to really create a tower defense game on top of photorealistic water, you know. So we did that and we called the title Navy Patrol Coastal Defense. And actually the title did really well. You know, it did so well that we were actually featured, you know, by Apple. That was in 2009, nice. Featured by Apple in September of 2009. So we thought that, you know, hey, we made it. Well, that, you know, we were happy for about 2 weeks until we weren't featured anymore and our app stopped dropping in the App Store.
So you're building ICS Mobile, you're cranking out these gaming apps. What's the next thing that kind of, how did you end up with Grow Credit? I mean, was there moment working on credit?
So the way, so what happened first, you know, so we had to find a way to become relevant, you know, within the App Store. So somehow we met a team, the founders at Tapjoy, And we started to integrate their system within our games. And then I came up with the idea, you know, a typical entrepreneurial story. You know, I had a month of cash left in the bank account. And then I came up with the freeappaday.com business model. Freeappaday, you know, was a platform that promoted paid apps for free. Developers would make their paid apps free within our platform. We had 12 million users, and we would essentially promote apps within 5 to 6 hours. An app, you know, would land in the top 10 in the App Store. I bootstrapped the company to $18.3 million in revenue in about 3.5 years, and 12 million users. It was a great business. We worked with Groupon, EA, Zynga, anyone who's anyone worked at one point or another with us. So that was the pivot, you know, away from the gaming to, you know.
That's exciting. I mean, so you're doing almost $20 million in revenue, self-funded. Did you guys sell the company? Did it just kind of naturally?
We were nicely shut down by Apple, in 2013. Apple changed the rules of the App Store, and they prevented apps from promoting other apps using push notification. So all of a sudden we went from making $500,000 to $1 million a month to nothing instantly. My office was literally a block away from science, and I knew Mike from various networking out here in Santa Monica, and Mike at science, and Mike Jones told me that, hey, you know, you should come at Science and help us with our user acquisition on mobile, you know, because Science back then, they didn't know anything. They didn't know much about mobile at all. So I was planning on taking a year off, but I decided to join Science as an EIR. And so I spent about 2 years there. And then, you know, Venmo, Robinhood, Acorns became popular. And this is when I thought that it would be a good idea to introduce credit score education and microlending in the U.S. And this is when I started Lenny Credit, which was the first, you know, exclusive lender on mobile, in the U.S. And we partnered with FICO to offer microloans to millennials, microloans from $100 up to $500. And we also offer them a free FICO score as well as credit score education.
Let me pause you for a second. So this is a separate business called Lenny Credit that you were working on prior to GrowCredit.
GrowCredit is a third pivot, but Lenny Credit was the original concept.
I like the name GrowCredit better.
Me too. It took us 5.5 years to get there to find the right name.
But so what did you see there? What did you see behind the scenes in credit? It's a slightly nuanced or niche sector of the financial industry. Was there something you saw or somebody you met that was like, this has got to be better than what it was?
Yeah, I mean, just from a context standpoint, right? You know, you have, you know, there's 100 million, according to, you know what I mean, based on the Experian data, you have 100 million consumers with no credit or thin credit files. That was pre-COVID-19. So you have over 100 million consumers, you know, who are unscorable, who are low credit score, no credit score at all. And by the way, we're talking about consumers, you know, who are doing, some of them are doing pretty well. You know, they work at Google, make, let's say, $150,000 a year, but they still have thin credit files, which makes their cost of financing very expensive.
And wow. And that's just in the U.S.? 100 million just in the U.S.? There's 300 million people total. So like half the people.
Imagine, but guess what? It was pre-COVID-19. It was pre. Imagine that. Since we're talking about over 50 million American consumers, you know, are unemployed right now. So that number exploded as well. So yes, wow. over half of the U.S. population basically has a need for a credit building solution. Okay. So, what accelerated this process, this situation actually started in 2009. It was a complete freakonomics situation that happened because after the 2008 crisis, the government, you know, enacted the CARD Act of 2009, which prevented banks from advertising on campus and prevented banks from extending credit to anyone under 21. So before 2009, you know, you remember, you went to college, you had banks all lined up giving you free credit cards, free money and all that. After 2009, you couldn't do that, and banks couldn't do that anymore. So in terms of Freakonomics, before 2009, even though you were late with your card payments, even though you didn't really manage your credit cards, you know, adequately, but since you started at age 18, by the time you graduate, you have 4 years of credit history. And that's enormous in terms of credit building capability, because credit history is 30%, you know, it's 15%. Credit length history is 15% of your credit score. So, and then if you made your payments on time for 4 years, making payments on time is 35% of your credit score. So now you have four years of positive repayment history. And that has a direct positive impact on your credit score in terms of increasing your credit score and lowering your cost of financing. And that enables you to, the consumers, to when they go out there to purchase a car, you know, they can, instead of having a credit score of 500 or 600, if you don't have any credit, with a credit score of 700 or 720, all of a sudden, your monthly payments for, let's say, a Volkswagen Jetta, you know, instead of just paying, you know, if you have a good credit score, you would be paying maybe $200 or $220. But with a credit score that's not good or with no credit history at all, we are talking about a payments of $300 and up to $400 a month just for the Volkswagen Jetta. So that's how impactful having a good credit card is for someone who's new to credit, you know,
Who's never had credit. So I'm just taking a step back for a second. Credit conceptually is effectively a digital representation of your reputation, right? I mean, and when cities were much smaller and there was no internet and no digital footprint, it was like, hey, Joe, I know you. I've known you for a while. We have seven friends in common. Therefore, you seem like a great guy from our past experience and working relationship. So your credit, which is the same thing as reputation, right, is high for me. So I'm more likely to make a loan to you. And the same can be true of a bank's relationship with you. Whereas typically you'd have to go into a bank, you know, they have to interview you and they're kind of like assessing you as to how likely you are to pay back your loan. And I think about credit as this proxy for digitizing proxy for reputation, which now becomes so quantitative and analytical that it's almost in a way more inefficient than it once was because it's overly analytical and quantitative, but the numbers aren't there. Like you say, if you don't have data on a person, you have no way institutionally of making an intelligent loan to them.
Exactly. I mean, it's all about trust. You know, I mean, you know, yeah. We're talking about Bitcoin and it's all about validation via trust. And the more trust, you know, a consumer, you know, receives, the higher the credit score. And what I mean by trust is the more positive repayment history that is reported to the credit bureaus from multiple, you know, financial institution, the higher the credit score. And the perfect example is if you have one credit card of $300 and I have three credit cards of $100, my credit score is going to be higher, will be higher than yours because more financial institution would have trusted me in terms of, would have extended credit to me. So more trust, higher credit score. And the FICO score, the entire reason to exist, you know, raison d'être in French, is the ability to assess the repayment capability of a consumer. That's all it is. So, you know, in a sense, and I'm sharing this because nowadays, you know, you have, you know, there's a movement, you know, even, you know, currently with the current politics with Biden and Kamala Harris, you know, the movement to report rent payment to the credit bureaus, you know, in order to make it count towards, to reflect a positive repayment history from a consumer. But it doesn't work that way because reporting, making your rent payments on time, there's no credit extension involved. There's no lending involved.
Oh, you have to have lending in order to have.
If there's no lending involved, so maybe your demo, basically your it won't affect the algorithm. Maybe you are saying to the algorithm, okay, I pay my bills on time. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, all the lenders wants to know, will you overextend yourself if I extend you too much credit? You know, it's all about...
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, will a consumer overextend themselves with a certain amount of loan? And that's the risk that, you know, every lender is trying to assess. How much
And it seems like credit... they have such limited information there. And ultimately, right, doesn't it come from these three credit bureaus with Experian, TransUnion, and what's the other one? Equifax? Do you know the history on those? I mean, how did we get so consolidated, which obviously has their massive risk potential, because was it Equifax that got hacked and like all the data was exposed a couple of years ago?
I don't remember which one got hacked, but you know, I mean, the history of the credit bureaus is I don't even know, you know. You know, the best way to explain it, it's more the history of FICO. FICO is at the base, you know, of all credit bureaus. FICO was created, I believe, in the 1960s, 70s, you know, to, you know, as an algorithm, you know, to determine, credit repayment capability. And then those credit bureaus, you know, have used FICO to create their own factors, you know, to determine, you know, the credit worthiness of a consumer. So all three bureaus, you know, work with FICO, but they all have a different ways to measure, you know, the credit worthiness of a consumer. So for instance, and they have, all of them have different scores depending on if a user is applying for a car or if a user is applying for a home. You know, the formula would be different to determine, you know, the credit worthiness of the consumer.
So FICO is, sorry to interrupt you, FICO is a private company. I didn't realize that. It's the legal name Fair Isaac Corporation.
That's correct.
Which was started in the 50s by this guy, Bill Fair and Earl Isaac. So it's a private company that we rely on to keep. Do they hold the sole data? If you could give me a little explanation as to when I make a loan with a car payment and I pay my bank monthly, is the bank then sending that information to FICO via some fax system, and then FICO has a giant warehouse where they store all this data in folders or servers, and then they send out to the credit bureaus? Or how does this work behind the scenes?
Behind the scenes is, yes, FICO, you know, so, you know, the data is, you know, the data is reported to FICO. And then, you know, the credit bureaus are repackaging the data, you know, to create a number, because all three bureaus have different scores, and they're repackaging the data, because the way the system works is that lenders, you know, are clients of the credit bureaus, you know, so they are lenders. If I'm going to lend you to purchase a home, you know, I'm purchasing the information from, Equifax or TransUnion, you know, to determine how much I should extend it. So each credit bureau has their own way, you know, to assess, you know, risk, you know, and for a car loan, for instance, maybe one credit score is more predictive, better, maybe Equifax is better, you know, than TransUnion. For, you know, a mortgage, maybe the best indicator is actually to use TransUnion instead of, so that's how, you know, so, you know, now the goal from a business standpoint, you know, the goals for those three bureaus is to signal that they are the best at predicting, you know, the credit, you know, repayment capability of a consumer. So they are competing. Mm. They are all competing to say, hey, we can predict, you know, the repayment capability of a consumer better than you.
And, but they all have the same input data, right? I mean, they're all taking whatever data.
They're using different formulas, you know, and they're using different formulas. And what happened at the end of the day, you know, after, let's say, if I'm a lender, if I work, you know, if I usually lenders sometimes they work with two or three, but then after a certain amount of time, if I see a pattern that, you know what, Equifax, you know, delivers, you know, Equifax scores, you know, have produced a better quality of users. At one point, I might decide just to work with Equifax. You know, so, you know, that's really, from, you have to look at it from a lender standpoint. They are always, you know, assessing which score, you know, is more appropriate, you know, for their specific lending activities. And that's why now we land into this current situation where now you have an enormous amount of population that have no scores because they don't have credit cards, they're using debit, and it's basically, and but they have good job, but it's impossible to score them. So imagine that you're going to charge 18% interest rate, you know, to someone who's making $180,000 a year just because the consumer is invisible. You know,
the more I learn about this, the more it seems like the whole system just needs to be completely not ripped out, but rethought and built up again. The fact that the banks are, I imagine the banks are getting paid or they're governmentally regulated to send data to FICO. And then, so you have FICO is like the central place that aggregates all this data from all these financial institutions that are issuing loans. FICO probably normalizes the data, and then they sell the data to these three credit bureaus. FICO makes $1 billion a year, so they're selling to three companies the data that they've collected. And then these three companies just probably turn and burn with nearly identical algorithms, and then they sell that access to the credit scores back out to other loaning and lending institutions. This system seems so archaic to me. I mean, what's your take on this? Do you look at this thing and feel like the more you learn, the more it just needs to be rebuilt entirely?
Not really.
You think it's efficient? I mean, is this how it's run in like France or other countries? It seems so lopsided.
Because the system is adapted to the United States because it is a credit extension heavy society. In Europe, it doesn't work that way. In Europe, it is, and I'm from France, right? In Europe, we know to extend credit, people look at your bank account, which makes total sense, right? And that's why now we can actually make a segue towards Grow Credit, because Grow Credit, that's what we're also doing, you know? What makes a distinction between, in the fact that before, you know, you would need to look at the credit portfolio, the credit history, you know, of a consumer to determine whether or not they are a good borrower. What we're doing, we are essentially doing the European way by peering through, you know, their checking account transaction history to be able to determine whether that user is creditworthy or not.
Got it. So your whole pitch is like, look, we're not going to go to the credit bureaus or to FICO. We don't need just lending data. There's other ways to assess somebody's potential payback alone.
That seems so obvious. That is correct. You know, that is how we're doing. That's why, you know, the company Brex is doing the exact same thing, you know, with corporation, you know, and we're doing what Brex is doing. We're doing the same thing with consumers.
Got it. Brex is doing that with corporations. So it's not corporations taking loans. Brex is going to individuals and
Brex is going to startups and extending credits to startups, you know, based on based on their cash flow transactions, based on their cash flow. You know.
Got it. So are you extending? Is Grow Credit extending credit? Are you providing a score? Are you actually providing money to people in credit?
No, we are offering a credit line to consumers to pay their subscriptions. So we sit in between a secured credit card and an unsecured credit card, in the sense that our users, we can receive the fund that we're extending them, they can only use those funds towards the subscriptions that we are supporting. You know, they can use it for Netflix, Spotify, Disney Plus, HBO Max, and they can apply those funds towards their cell phone plan as well. So from a business standpoint, you know, we are extending an unsecured line, but that unsecured line is secured in a sense that you can only use it towards, you know, subscriptions that you are already using to a certain extent, even though you can add more newer subscriptions on our platform. So it's a way to essentially reward consumers, you know, for behavior that they are already, you know, they are already having, making those payments, and we are making those, recurring payments count towards building, a better credit score.
So if I use my credit card, if I say I just whipped out my Visa and I paid for Spotify now, that is a loan technically, right? Because the credit card company is paying for the $15 payment, and then I'm paying them at the end of the month. So does that not count towards my credit as it currently stands?
So the way it works, right? You know, when if you use a credit card, you know, to pay your Netflix account, yes, you know, it's going to show an activity. You're going to pay. You will pay back. You will be paying back that that loan at the end of each month. You know, yes, because there's a credit transaction that's involved. However, because of 2009 and the Card Act of a lot of millennials are using debit cards.
Oh, okay.
Debit cards, and with debit cards, you know, there are no lending involved in the process. Meaning, paying your subscription with your debit card has no impact on your credit score. However,
why are they using debit cards? They just don't know that using credit cards build credit, or they don't have a credit
card. The Card Act did was preventing consumers from getting access to credit. So since 2009, it's a lot harder for consumers to obtain to qualify for a credit card. So that's what the 2009 Card Act did. Before the 2009 Card Act, you went to college, I went to college, banks were giving us credit card. After 2009, it became really hard for consumer to obtain a credit card. And also there are some psychological aspect that happened as well, because millennials became wary of credit because of what happened to their parents, and they decided to use debit, you know, as a better, you know, payment mechanism that would prevent them from
overspending, having, right?
Overspending, exactly. So it's there's a psychological aspect to it, and then there's a practical access to it, in the sense that the system, the structure, you know, prevented all swath of the population from obtaining a credit card, or even obtaining a credit card at a cheap rate. Because at some point, you know, the way consumers have been able to circumvent this was by, you know, obtaining a secured credit card. A secured credit card has been for the longest, you know, the easiest way to get access to credit. But the problem with the secured card, well, you have to secure it with your own funds. So you have to commit back $300, to be able to have a 300 credit. So it's collateralized by your own funds. So it's not, you know, it's not real credit.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's what a secured card is. You have to have money in the bank in order to use it. Yeah, which kind of defeats the point.
But and on top of that, you're getting charged $35, you know, to $50. And you're getting charged an interest rate as well. Imagine that. You're getting charged an annual fee and some interest rates on your own money in order to prove that you're credit worthy. That's crazy.
But I'd be curious to hear your take on it. But the more I learn about the Credit Card Act of 2009, the more I just feel this whole industry became more lopsided and more screwy and less efficient because of these rules. I mean, what was the impetus for this rule in the first place? Why did politicians feel this was a good idea?
It was a good idea. It was a way to prevent predatory lending. and to prevent.
What is predatory lending? How do you define? Like, give me an example of predatory lending.
I mean, you know, in a specific case of credit cards, it was to prevent banks from extending credit to consumers who are not, you know, credit savvy. They knew that. Listen, you give a $500 credit card to a young person who's 18 years old, who's never had a credit card. What do you think they're going to do with it? You know, they're going to be late, so they're going to be able. They were able to generate revenue from late fees. You know, there are. You know, it was a major fee. You remember the bank business is a fee generation business, so they were able to generate an enormous amount of fees for consumers misbehaving. And of course, if you're young, yeah, the likelihood to misbehave is pretty high, especially in a college environment. So that CARD Act was created to curtail, you know, that predatory, you know, environment that essentially had banks preying on a misinformed audience in order to extract as much fee as possible, you know, from consumers.
So I mean, were they lying to the kids? I mean, or just
you don't need to lie. It's just you go to no, it's not about lying. You're asking someone who's young to become responsible at a young age in a college environment. So the environment, that's all it is. You know, you're giving $500 to someone who probably never had a credit card before. That person never had a credit card before. You're giving him $500, free money, conceptually, that he doesn't have to repay at the end of each month. So obviously, that person, the likelihood for that person to overextend themselves is very high.
God, it almost seems to me, I mean, my thought is it's an educational problem. It's not a... you know, it's not a predatory lending. However, I see the argument, but
banks have no interest. I mean, if your entire business is predicated on generating fee revenues from late fees or for overdraft protection fees, you have zero interest in educating your audience. None. That's the entire business. Banking. Mm-hmm. You've seen what happened with a company like Dave, for instance. You know, they became very popular because of their overdraft protection product. You know, the entire banking system, it's a fee generation business. Banks have no vested interest in educating their audience, because if they do, they're generating less revenue. That's it.
Well, here, do you think, tell me if this is a narrative that you would take on board. So prior to 2009, opening a bank was very challenging, and the internet certainly didn't foster web banking. There's probably regulations preventing, you know, if you and I wanted to start a bank to compete with People's, USAA or Chase or whatever, it'd be very hard. And the outcome of that is that banks had a local oligopolies or monopolies in certain areas because of regulatory barriers preventing entrepreneurs from creating alternative options for banks. And so because of that moat, so to speak, there was no competition on banks. So banks could become predatory. They could offer people really high interest rates or high fees that hide it all, make it a terrible user experience. Because ultimately, when people sign up for services, call it a bank service, and they feel really frustrated and they feel like this is a terrible product, they want competition. They want other options that they believe in. You know, they're going to tell their friends, hey, I'm getting ripped off by People's Bank or USAA or whatever it is. And that's where I see the problem is, like, maybe we should have peeled back the rules and allowed more competition on the financial services sector so that we could offer young people a better service instead of blocking. I don't know. I mean, does that make sense?
But that's exactly what happened over the past 5 years. You know, Plaid has been at the renaissance or the source of that neobank explosion in the United States. You know, when you see a platform like Chime, you know, Dave, you know, Venmo, those platforms are all powered by Plaid. Plaid was purchased by Visa for $5.1 billion, if the number is correct. Was it 5.1? Yes.
That's a lot of billions.
Lots of billions, you know, back in February. Because Plaid is powering this entire new banking, fintech banking revolution. You know, and that fintech banking revolution are providing fair solutions to American consumers. You know, you have, you know, Shine, for instance, some, you know, that are providing completely bank-free, fee-free services, such as a platform called, a bank called Aspiration.
Aslo?
Aspiration. Oh. The name of the bank is called Aspiration. And it's a completely free bank, and that you know, that is consumer friendly, and that the purpose of the bank is to you know, the fees, the consumers can pay whatever they want, and some of the proceed goes towards good causes. For instance, that's Aspiration, that received a lot of funding over the past few years. You know, you have a platform like Earnin, for instance, which has destroyed, you know, the payday loan industry by allowing you know, consumers to borrow money, to have pay advances with no fees at all. The entire business model for Earnin is that they can advance consumers' funds on their salary, and the consumer can pay them back any fee they want. It's a tip based system.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
And they raised, I think, $900 million with a tip fee system only. So there's been a massive revolution, you know, with the Chime, with Plaid, with Dave, you know, and with us.
Yeah, with you guys.
A massive revolution, you know, to provide fair solutions, you know, to consumers. In our case, we are the first platform to enable consumers to establish or build credit for free.
Are you focusing on younger consumers though? Are you, the Bank Card Act, from what I understand, is 21 and under is the rules that they're trying to help protect, quote unquote. Are you guys, is that your target demo, 21 and under?
In the United States, so when you have 100 to 150 million consumers who are struggling with their credit score, we don't have any target market. Anyone uses us. We know right now, you know, since we launched, you know, If your consumers are trying to build or rebuild credit, you know, or basically start off their credit history, you know, we are open to anyone, and our consumer portfolio, you know, is very vast, because anyone, you know, has a vested interest, you know, in a building their credit score, you know, as early as possible. And again, from a value proposition standpoint, we are able to do it for free. So that's the first platform to enable consumers to establish credit without accumulating more debt. So that's really unique as a platform.
I love it. And the website is beautiful. So the business model, correct me if I'm wrong, is you offer a credit card to people that have, you can only use this credit card for approved subscriptions. And when you pay using those subscriptions, it's there's no fees, but then you guys take that data about the person, you know, this person's been paying for 5 subscriptions for 7 months now, and you send that data to the credit bureaus, and then that's how you guys get compensated. Is that right?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not
all right. All. We're 49 minutes in, and I'm still swinging and missing. Nah, great. Correct me where I'm wrong.
The way we generate, you know, we are a freemium model. Okay. The way we generate revenue, from an interchange revenue, we are MasterCard. By the way, We just completed a partnership with MasterCard, who's became a strategic investor in Grow Credit. So, we are generating interchange fee revenue. That's it. So with our free model, if someone, you know, each time someone pays their Netflix, you know, with our Grow Card, we're just generating some interchange fees from that transaction. But, you know, it's an interchange business revenue, but also a good chunk of our users are also upgrading, you know, to our premium plan. So we have a plan that's the Grow membership, that's $4.99, and they get access to $50 in credit that gets spent towards any subscriptions. And then another plan that's $9.99, and they get access to $150 in credit that they can apply towards any subscriptions, including their cell phone bills. So essentially, from a pure value proposition standpoint, you know, we're enabling consumers to build credit for free, build credit with their cell phone bills, build credit with their subscriptions, and we are enabling consumers to obtain subscription discounts as well. So we won't see exactly. So yes. So that's the value proposition is not only they can build credit, they with one single payment and they pay all their subscriptions, but they also get subscription discounts at the same time.
So these guys are paying for credit, right? You're saying $5 a month for 50 or 10 for 150.
That's correct.
Got it. That's interesting. Is most of the revenue from these subscriptions or from the interchange?
It's a blend. You know, we also have a good chunk of our users who actually are tipping us. We're getting tips, just like the earning model. You know, we have a good chunk of our users are tipping us because we're delivering true value. You know, we're having a real impact on their credit score. We're talking about, a 61 point average increase in a 9 month span. And we're talking about users with no credit whatsoever. You know, with a sample size of 850 users, you know, we have users who ended up with credit scores ranging from, 620 to 720 after 9 months of using us. So the platform
awesome.
The platform is effective, and it allows them to save enormously on a variety of credit product. So just again, the Fallers Pack and Jetta. Yes, you know, by using Grow, instead of paying $200 a month, $350 a month, now they can pay $200 a month, you know, if they've been using our platform, if they've been behaving and making their payments on time with their Grow credit accounts.
And how do you, how are they depositing money? Are you using a bank on the backside to be able to issue, to hold the money or collect money?
We are collecting the money via ACH. So we're extending them credit, and we are extending credit. We have a bank partner. We have two bank partners, actually four bank partners. You know, we have an issuing bank that's responsible for issuing the card. You know, we have one bank that's responsible for lending us, you know, providing us with a warehouse line of credit to extend those credit lines. And we have two other bank partners that are acting as the lender of record, meaning which gives us the regulatory umbrella, you know, to provide the service across the nation.
Wow, how was it setting up those relationships? Was that straightforward or like a massive pain in the ass?
It's extremely hard. So fortunately, we have one of our co-founding member, you know, she has 33 years of experience in banking, and that has helped us a lot. You know, it took about a year to set up those relationships. You know, imagine that, working four banks. You know, to be able to partner with a bank, you know, everything needs to be on the up and up, you know, with that compliance standpoint, from a compliance standpoint, from a financial model standpoint. And, you know, it's a testament of the enormous amount of work that our team have done to achieve those bank partnerships. And by the way, have to be a completely secured platform as well.
Go ahead.
Secure, like encrypted secure? Technically?
It's a bank level security. Yes.
Wow. So I imagine the process was like you get in touch with someone at the bank, they point you to somebody else, you guys set up some meetings, they review your business model, and then you go into diligence phase. Did you need to have a lot of revenue? I mean, you couldn't have, right? Because you needed them to start the business in the first place. So it was like a chicken and the egg problem initially with banks.
Yeah, it's a case, in our case, we had a solid business model and, we had a solid business model and partnership with a MasterCard before becoming a strategic investor. MasterCard was a partner as well, you know, so, and then we had a pedigree, we had a background, you know, we've been, with Grow Credit, I've been involved with credit, with Lenny Credit since 2015. So we had a history.
That helps.
We had a history. That helps, you know, speed up things.
And do you send the credit to the one piece I'm missing in my mind, my mental model for this, is how does the credit scores or the credit bureaus get this information? Does it go from your banking partners to FICO and back to the credit bureaus, or do you guys send it directly?
Yeah, we know. We are reporting directly to the credit bureaus.
Got it. Is that like an email that you send? I'm just so curious is it like an API that they have where you just basically post data to?
You need to build a relationship. That's another hurdle. You need to build establish relationship with all three credit bureaus, which is another set of hurdles. It takes several months to get up and running. You need to make sure that they want to make sure that your bank partnerships are in place. They want to make sure that the way you're collecting data are in place. So that's just another a pain. You know, first of all, it's a major pain to get in touch with the banks. Then to be able to report to the credit bureaus is also a major challenge. You know, you need to have build a relationship and make sure that you have enough consumers. So you have a chicken and an egg here because they want you to have enough consumers to be able to report. So it's it's a very challenging a puzzle that we had to
weave. Yeah, God, man, I give you so much credit. This is a tough business.
Five and a half years. Yeah, it's it's a very complicated puzzle. And
And so your part, I would say you probably have a lot of gray hair from this, but last I remember, you were bald.
I'm bolder.
Bolder. Man. Once you have all these relationships in place, it sounds like you needed to build a massive foundation, and then you get to enter the arena and do marketing and customer acquisition and everything else like a normal SaaS company would.
Exactly. And the customer acquisition, that's my user, my expertise. So this is, I was a user, I'm a marketer first. That's why the platform is built as a user acquisition platform first. Mm. And then that's my background, user acquisition and marketing. So I became a fintech guy, but now this is where I'm going to be able to use my skills to further, grow the platform. We're looking at reaching about 1 million consumers by the end of 2021 and 4 million by the end of 2022.
So, wow, you can finally enter the arena and start sprinting.
Yeah,
pun intended. And where do you find them? Is it mostly on like social media and Google ad spend and Instagram and that kind of stuff?
You worked at Science. It's the same. The formula is pretty straightforward, right? 80% of your traffic comes from Facebook and Google, and then Google. That's it. And 20% is a little bit of everything else.
It's amazing. Everything else is the fun part. That's where you get the edge, though. All the like ad networks and partnerships.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm. That's cool. Do you guys work with?
In our case, influencer marketing, is one of our top, channel for us.
So, that's interesting. Yeah, that seems like a massively growing area. Yeah, that seems like it's gonna impact Facebook and Google ad spend pretty soon. Interesting, man. Man, I could spend another hour, I'm sure, asking all these questions, learning about it, but. I'll respect your time. This is really fun. Where can people find you? And then what would be helpful for you guys? What are you guys looking for?
People can find us. We are, at www.growcredit.com. I'm also on LinkedIn at, Joe Bayen. And, we're not looking for, we secured all the partnerships that we needed, the bank partnership that we needed, the partnership with MasterCard. We just completed a $2.4 million before MasterCard's arrival. We completed a $2.4 million raise. So right now we are pretty set on the fundraising front for the next 6 months. And we might go out for our A round, we believe, within the next 6 months.
How about engineers or any people on the staffing side? Or I imagine customers always, but...
Our team is in Portugal. My co-founder is in Portugal, actually, so we are benefiting from very good and cheap engineers. And however, our data science team is in LA. So we have to build our data science team here. And if we would be hiring more data scientists in the coming month.
Awesome, man. Well, congrats, Joe. You're a beast. I don't know how you get all this done. Work ethic.
I have a cat. That's how you get it done. A cat.
Yeah. Yeah, a cat. Yeah, the cat is the secret, I'm sure. Well, listen, man, this has been a fun conversation. And people can reach out to you. You're Joe Bayon on Twitter. And hopefully have you back on for another show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Joe.
All right.
If you're still listening, consider giving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate it. We also now have a Patreon page where if you feel generous and you'd like to help us continue to produce the show, please contribute. Anything you can would be greatly appreciated. We've self-funded this show for over 7 years now out of our own pockets, and it is not free. So any contribution you could make is greatly appreciated. If you'd like us to bring on any other guests to the show, just reach out on Twitter at Around the Coin. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much, really, and hope you enjoy the next show.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.